Okay, at this point, I will introduce our panelists for our first panel this morning. First up is Hina Dadaboy. Where are you, Hina? There you are. Hina spent their childhood as a practicing Muslim who never in their right mind would have believed that they would grow up to be an atheist, feminist, secular humanist. This afternoon, they will be giving a talk titled Apostasy Ahoy, Signs I Was Destined for Atheism. Please welcome Hina Dadaboy to the stage. Next up is Debbie Goddard. Debbie is the current outreach coordinator at the Center for Inquiry. As a part of her job, she works with secular student groups like ours to help us improve our group. This afternoon, she will be giving a talk about effective forms of activism. Please welcome Debbie Goddard to the stage. Last up is Candace Gorham. Candace is the author of The Ebony Exodus Project, Why Some Black Women Are Walking Out on Religion. This afternoon, she will be giving a talk titled Jesus is All You Need and Other Lies the Church Tells Black Women. Please welcome Candace Gorham to the stage. Together, they will be tackling various issues that women face as being a part of the secular movement. And now I'm going to hand it over to AHA's co-outreach chair, Margaret Babe, who is also my lovely partner. She will be moderating the panel.
Can y'all hear me? Oh, I can hear me. Thank you, Mr. President and Mr. Boyfriend. I'm Margaret, as you all know. These are our lovely panelists. Welcome, friends. Thank you again for coming. So we have four subtopics we'll be discussing over the course of this panel. All the ladies have a sheet in front of them. Our first subtopic will be discrimination and the statistical divide. Questions include, why are there less women statistically than men in secularism? What causes this difference? Why does religion seem less misogynistic and more accepting than secularism to some women? Is this common? Do women face discrimination that is specific to the secular community, or is the discrimination they encounter there on par with the discrimination they face elsewhere? And is there a type of discrimination that is uniquely encountered in the secular community?
So much ground, enough for, you know, a whole panel. You just want us to jump in?
Yes, you may speak at will, but if discussion becomes kind of quick, you can hold up your name placard to make sure we aren't cutting anybody off. Okay. You can have your free reign, though.
I guess this is one that I'm just going to tackle. It's the last question we heard. Is there a type of discrimination specific to the secular community? I will say that there is one, and it's the evolutionary psychology flavor of sexism, where women like pink because of berries and men like blue because of the sky and, you know, go home and make me a sandwich kind of thing, because science. It's obviously a gross misinterpretation of evolutionary theory and evolutionary psychology, but it's common and it's everywhere, and there's no point in no true Scotsmaning it. Those people are around.
Well, as a mental health counselor, I must say I'm not 100% sure how much I agree with that, but not that that is a big deal.
But what do you mean? Don't you meet these people?
Apparently not. Not many. I'm just saying in general, I do think that there's a whole lot to be said for evolutionary psychology. Not necessarily that, like, the sky is blue or pink or whatever. But I mean, I do think that there's a lot to it. And I guess it's something I was just talking to somebody about recently, actually, as far as something I want to study.
To be clear, I'm not saying it's a bad discipline and it should feel bad and nobody should study it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that people take it in this sexist direction that I only really find within the secular community. Mm-hmm. That's all I meant. I'm not raining on your parade for revolutionary psychology.
Right, right.
Yeah, when people have made justifications for why there are fewer women involved in the secular movement, they've said because women aren't as rational, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
And evolutionary psychology shows us so.
I have heard that before. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I think, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay. I mean, I think, though, there is something to be said about the fact that just in general, statistically speaking, there are more women who are involved in religious activities or who, you know, profess stronger levels of religiosity than men. So, if 80% of them are over there versus, I don't know, whatever the number is, 60-some percent of men, you know, then sort of, it will sort of be expected that there would be fewer. But because everybody's always wondering, like, you know, how can religion is so misogynistic? Like, how can women still be, you know, such conservative Christians or whatever? And so I think that in general is sort of a growing something that women are starting to see more, you know, but just on a proportional scale, I think that's sort of, to a certain degree, answers the question.
So why is religion more, why are fewer women involved in secularism, and why are there more women in religion?
Well, you just said it, because we're not rational beings. No.
Not enough.
I thought
things.
We clarified that already. No, I don't know.
I mean, I have some insight just from a former Muslim perspective. You know, there are women I know in my family who love me, respect me. And we have conversations about this all the time. You know, when I first came out as an atheist, one of my relatives came up to me in tears and said, "How can you believe that there isn't any justice?" She said, you know, bloodthirsty, genocidal dictators die warm, happy, and fat in their beds with their 10 mistresses on their arms. How can you believe that they're not going to be punished? How can you live in a world where they get away with it? And I said, well, that's the world we live in, right? But for her, you know, that was one of the biggest pulls of religion, was this idea that she clearly saw the injustice in the world and felt so helpless to do much about it. And so religion offered her that comfort. And another relative of mine, I brought up the fact that, you know, according to many iterations of Islam, women are obligated to have sex with their husbands, whether they want to or not. There's no such thing as marital rape in Islam. If you are married to somebody, he has access to your body unless you're menstruating or otherwise incapacitated, according to Islamic law. And, you know, I brought that up to her, and her response was, well, my husband wouldn't do something like that. You know, he wouldn't. And I said, well, what if he did? You know, his religion isn't stopping him. The point is, I think a lot of these women build their lives around religion. They've lived their whole lives for religion and for God. And if they try to leave it, it's essentially saying all that time and all that effort was a waste. And for people in more involved religions like Islam or Mormonism or anything, it can be hard to say, well, that was all crap and it didn't mean anything. And I spent, you know, 25 years of my life doing something that's completely empty and fake. So I think that's hard too for them.
Do you guys think it's all just because women are, in general, the keepers of tradition, like religion or otherwise? You know, women are socially the keepers of our institutions, right? The keeper of the family, and this is just our society, culture set it up for whatever reason. So as the keepers, they're keeping religion too, just like they're keeping patriarchy, just like they're keeping, you know, sexuality safe. You know, they are keepers in our society. So religion is just something else they're keeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, I do. I think, you know, I was going to say that was sort of where my thinking was going, especially from sort of a social support sort of standpoint. You know, it's like that's where, especially like I said, for black women, of course, I'm going to keep coming to that, being that it's like about 85% of black women in the United States profess some level, you know, of religiosity. That's where we are. You know what I'm saying? It's like if you want black female friends, you got to have, you know, religious ones, and that's where you're going to kind of go and get that community and that support, which of course I argue really is not the best community and support, but you know, that's sort of where they are, and that's kind of where everybody gets, you know, stuck. Yeah.
I think it also relates to how, and don't take me wrong on this, but I think it relates to the kind of cerebral and intellectual movement we are. I'm not saying lady brains are dumb, but instead, what I noticed in I studied philosophy as an undergrad, and there were a lot of women in my initial classes, but when you went into philosophy of science, for example, you didn't see as many women there, because you saw them in other kinds of philosophy classes, like feminist philosophy, in the same way that you see African-Americans taking African-American studies courses, but you don't see them taking Asian-American studies courses and vice versa. So the women and African-Americans who were getting involved in philosophy were studying or interested in other things, a different range of things than a lot of the white men who were involved, who were getting into fields like philosophy of science. Applying that to the secular community, I think if we are focused on things like philosophy and science and the kinds of meetings we have, then there are women who are atheists and secular who may be, who may have been interested in the kinds of things we do, but some of the issues that we tackle are not as relevant to their lives. And so if they're going to get involved in groups or movements, they might get involved in social justice-oriented movements or feminism or working in politics or things like that, finding groups that do other kinds of things because they have other pressing, relevant issues to address. It's one thing I keep thinking. And then they're like, why don't you care about these important things? And it's like, well, I have these other important things that I have to worry about too.
One of the questions that I think is that we haven't really quite got to yet that I think is important is, why does religion seem less misogynistic and more accepting than secularism for some women? One of the things that I've been thinking about lately is about how we're a lot more likely to actually deal with our problems as a movement. That is one thing that we have in our favor. We actually talk about these things. There's not a culture of silence and shame as much. There is some of it, of course there is, it's everywhere, but it's much less than in religion. So, you know, when a religious leader has some sort of scandal, everybody does their best to be quiet about it, to be polite about it, to not talk about it. Whereas, you know, that's all we talk about sometimes, really. So I feel like that's part of it too, is that there's this perception that there's more problems here than there, but that's because over there they don't really deal with it a lot of the time.
I know one of the issues that came up when, in the last 4 years, there has been a lot of interest in the secular community in issues around women being harassed at conferences and in secular spaces or made to feel uncomfortable, and women coming forward. I would say that to me there seemed to be an increase in this starting around 2011 and then going from there, but women coming forward and saying, yeah, I actually have had those experiences too. I stopped going to my local group meetings because I kept getting creeped on. I've gone to conferences and these things happened. And it seemed that there were other women and a lot of men who said, I don't think that happens. I've never seen that happen. That doesn't happen. I've never seen it. And part of that, I think, is reinforced by some of our kind of fundamental and much touted values of our movement, which is to be evidence-based thinkers. And if we've had experiences of going to conferences and never seeing harassment happen because we're not people who get harassed or tend to be harassed at conferences, it's hard for us to be like, what, there's this whole culture of harassment? Nah, what are you talking about? I don't think that's true. You're probably blowing something out of proportion. In the same way that like people are like, I don't think racism happens anymore. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? I see racism all the time. They're like, no, I never see that. So
my friends would never do that.
Yeah, it gets reinforced. And that's something I think we're addressing, but on surface levels without thinking about why our core values of our movement might perpetuate that kind of culture and thinking of like, different people can have different experiences. That's unreasonable. Yeah. That's not enlightenment thinking. Yeah. So that's kind of a, I wouldn't say unique, but there's more of that in this movement.
It's a lot of, I think, sorry.
All right, I really hate to cut off a discussion, but for the sake of giving enough time to each subtopic, it's actually a great segue into subtopic number two, which is making communities more welcoming. So this includes questions such as, how do we make our communities more inviting and welcoming to women? What strategies have been proven effective in doing this? What can we do about microaggressions? And perhaps most relevantly, how can we deal with loudly sexist, racist, and or heterosexist members of our community?
Well,
kind of what I was about to say relates
to
it.
I'll mine was kind of about to say that too. Kind of related to a certain degree. Yeah, I mean, I think that, so how do we make them more inviting? I mean, we definitely need to address stuff out in the open, like you were saying, you know, we need to put stuff on the table. But as the movement grows, we're starting to see more and more infighting. You know, we were talking about that last night. There's a whole lot of this infighting, and there's a whole lot of, like, throwing out names and stuff like that. And I feel like, so we need to talk about the bigger issues, but I think that there also need to be people who just kind of go straight to the perpetrator and say, dude, not cool, get the, well, can I curse in here? I'm sorry. You know, get out of here. And as an anecdotal story is on one of my local groups. If you are not part of our community, you would totally think that we're one of the most racist, sexist group in the world. But we totally love each other and we all get along. So there was this one guy, however, who was really taking it over the top. And so there's this one group that has like a monthly pool party and everybody's cool. It's all good. And this one guy would always be like, he was kind of the creeping guy on the group who apparently liked to make porn with big women. And so he would slowly sort of creep around and, like, tap people on the shoulder. And, like, after, you know, a couple of women complained about it, the guy who organized it was like, get the fuck out of here. You know what I'm saying? Dude, you, like, just sort of pulled him to the side at the actual event, you know, didn't make a big scene of it. And was just like, get out of here, dude. You know, you're disgusting. You're not welcome back. And so that was one of those things was, like, we in the group, we knew that he was gross. We knew that the guy who was the organizer kicked him out. But because he took such swift action, it didn't blow up and become a big, huge thing. And we didn't end up having to get into a whole lot of infighting and stuff. So as far as how to make it more inviting, go back, you know, it's just sort of having some people in there who are willing to sort of step up and take swift action about it. And then we can still discuss it, but without it becoming a huge, nasty, you know, fight.
So anyway, to go back, oh no, it's okay.
We're on a panel.
One thing that it relates to what Deb was saying earlier about the way that we view things often in the sort of rational, skeptical community is sort of one thing that we can do to make it more welcoming is to reframe our standards of evidence. You know, the idea that you need falsifiable scientific theory level proof for something like that guy harassed me is completely ludicrous. It's you're viewing things with the wrong scope. When it comes to interpersonal issues and people's personal safety, you don't need, you know, what are you gonna do? Put him in a room and have 100 women walk by him and see if he harasses them? Is that the study you're gonna conduct? You know, what possible study could prove that? And so we need to sort of think about the difference between what we want as a standard of evidence and proof for our worldviews versus interpersonal relationships and community issues.
Yeah, on that, I love talking about strategy. I love it so much. I'm so excited about it. But it's so complicated because people are complicated. And we all have our own biases. And we all have our own experiences and different perspectives and motivated reasoning and all of these things. If the question is, how can we make our communities more inviting and welcoming to women, the question is really addressing, how do we make communities? Not, how do we, how do I phrase it? What are our core values as freethinkers? And one of the issues that has come up about this that's a little outside of talking just about women in the community, but how we think about how to build good communities has been free expression issues and people saying, well, it's my First Amendment right to say X, Y, Z, so you shouldn't stop that. Well, if our goal is let's build a good community, whether that be an online space or an in-person space, you want to have, you know, 2 meetings a month for 3 hours apiece and everyone goes out to a bar afterwards, First Amendment rights be damned. If someone's calling people racist names, get the hell out of my community. Because we have a goal for making that space. And the goal is figure out how to get people, some range of people, together to do things. And in line with that goal, we need to set community rules and community standards, not to say, well, free for all, we all support free inquiry and the First Amendment, anything goes here. In the same way that if we are having this panel discussion and someone stands up and starts, I don't know, singing the Star Spangled Banner in the back, like, do they have a First Amendment right to do so? But should they be doing that in this room when we're trying to do something else, when there's a goal to making a space like this and a conference like this? No, and we're going to try to remove them from this space, right? Or tell them, no, that's not acceptable. You have to sit down or you have to get out. And there's a lot of resistance to this idea that you can have these spaces, I'm not saying safe space, but in all our spaces, we have social expectations, social norms, guidelines for behavior, community standards. And sometimes those butt against how people want to behave in our spaces, but we have to think about that goal of how to build community, how to get people to show up. And that involves maybe harassment policies. That involves telling people your behavior is not acceptable here. We want to get more women in this group. Please stop macking on every single person that comes in this door.
There's a term for that, mactivism.
Mactivism.
To deal with, really quick, when you deal, okay, so if you happen to see somebody being racist, sexist, whatever, very loudly, for the love of all that is good in the universe, do not leave that person alone. There have been so many times where some loud sexist has cornered me and everybody giggles nervously and leaves me alone with him. Mm. What I need is one person to stand up to him and say, dude, can you cut it out? Mm. That is all I need. If I get one person in that situation to stand up with me and for me and to back me up, it does a world of difference.
Mm. Yeah, I can say so much on that.
So one thing, as a mother of an 11-year-old, stuff like family-friendly events, stuff like, okay, in your local groups, if you guys are going to have an adult get-together, one or two volunteers to say, hey, I'll keep the kids at my house. You guys go have fun. Conferences like this to have, you know, stuff for the children so that you can bring your children. I mean, you know, my mom works weekends and she had to put in time off a month in advance to, you know, be at my house. Like, stuff like that is huge. I mean, if you got small children, I mean, stuff like that is just like some of the biggest, hugest, most amazing support that as a woman I could have. What? Watch my kid? Hell yeah, I'm there, dude. So like, that's the kind of stuff I say we really need to consider, you know, think, especially, you know, with families that have small children and things like that. And like, anyway.
Yeah, and one of the questions is how to deal with these members, and we talked about members who make loudly racist, sexist, or homophobic remarks, and we said, in some cases, if you see people doing it, stand up and address it, like, hey, that's not okay here, so you're laying out the standards of behavior. A lot of times, this is something actually James Croft was asked last night, what can we do about Ferguson? We're not in Ferguson. What can we do about issues of police brutality? And he said, you know, start by listening, things like that. But one thing we can do to address structural racism, racism in society, is I think a part of the angle of the question is like, what can we as not people of color do about this? But one thing to do is, like, white people need to do anti-racist work with other white people, because a lot of the time those attitudes get reinforced as, it's okay except when I'm around people of color. It's okay to make sexist comments except when I'm around women, right? It's okay to say homophobic things except when I'm around gay people. This is something that's come up. So in groups, like trying to build free thought community groups or in online spaces, again, creating systems of kind of cultural pressure to say, like, that's not so okay is a good idea. And a lot of times it's most effective when it's coming from peers. I started an African Americans for Humanism discussion group on Facebook. And we had a lot of sexists and homophobes for a bit. And I first didn't want to deal with it. I was like, well, people will talk it out. And then I found that women were leaving my group. And I didn't want that. There was a reason I built a group, right? And I retooled the expectations, and now I send every new member something saying, we do not tolerate homophobia and sexism in this group. So they know what the guidelines are, and they can mess up once, and I send them a very polite warning, unless it's egregious, but they can mess up once, I send them a warning, and then I kick them out the second time. So yeah, we need to, as leaders and organizers, do that, and it's a little better to do it peer-to-peer. So if there's a white guy in your group who's being problematic, and you can get another white guy to tell him, yo, that's not cool for these reasons, that person's more likely to listen. Those are some strategies, at least, that I found to work. word.
That's using your privilege for good, by the way, is speaking to your peers
also
and telling them,
people
hey.
Color ice cream. No, kidding. Regarding microaggressions, like there have been, again, in our community, in our movement, there have been topics that have come up a lot, it seems, more recently because of, I think, ability for online communication and things. People have been discussing diversity. People have been using the word privilege, talking about what microaggressions are, defining harassment for people. If you're group leaders or members of groups or even participating in online spaces and you haven't, we could all stand to learn more about this better. And so we don't need to just talk about philosophy and science and religion in our groups and in our spaces. There are a lot of sociology topics that we can learn. If our fundamental reasons for building groups are critical thinking, skepticism, secularism, humanism, atheism, why don't we talk about these other things? Why don't we bring in sociologists, psychologists, and things for presenting to us, starting discussions, having these kinds of topics added to our repertoire in our groups. Mm-hmm. It's very useful, I think.
That sort of makes me think, again, going back to the family issue I was thinking earlier, you know, too, like, what about we have a presentation about, you know, raising kids in secularism or, you know, some of the just sort of practical everyday, like just normal people, because we are just normal people. Like, just let's just talk about some normal stuff, you know, like as opposed to, I mean, the big topics are important, the critical thing. My mindset is always there's room for everything, guys. Like, let's bring it all to the table. And like I said, again, as a mother, you know, there are, Mothers Beyond Belief groups and stuff like that on Facebook, and they're awesome because, you know, that's all we do. Like, you know, we talk about mothering children as, you know, atheists and agnostics and stuff, and like Daddies Beyond, I don't know what, Beyond Belief, let's come up with some kind of 3D anachronism for men and like all of that. Like, let's just start doing some stuff that's make normal people talk about.
We've got time for one question.
What I find super troubling and perhaps the biggest challenge to the sort of efforts that you're talking about, a challenge for them to be able to get traction, is the behavior of some of the most prominent people in our community. I mean, going back to the evolutionary biology thing, Christopher Hitchens breaks my heart when I see the YouTube thing where he's explaining why women can't be funny comedians. Mm. But then, back to the welcoming community, Richard Dawkins with his ridiculous fearless Lima letter in the face of Elevator Gate. In the wake of Elevator Gate. And then, of course, the other thing where people close ranks when someone is accused of doing the worst thing, not just macking on somebody, but pulling Bill Cosby's on people. So I would really like to hear comments about that. What can we do, and how can we, as a movement, be strong when we're being knocked down from the very top?
I take sort of the radicals approach. I stop supporting them. I unlink them. I never link them on my blog, things like that. But I mean, I don't have a whole lot of power on my own. But I think that just taking a stance in that way, and, you know, if you see someone with, you know, who's supporting somebody who has these issues, you can always privately let them know, just in case you didn't know, they're not so great for XYZ reasons. And I mean, yeah, there are a lot of figureheads, I won't name names, but there are certain figureheads who definitely make the community seem a lot less welcoming than it can be. But part of it is, I think, and this is my new working theory, a lot of these articles that complain about these figureheads who are so problematic fail to mention anybody else. They're constantly promoting these people. They're complaining, oh, atheism is all just, you know, racist, sexist white men. But who are they actually promoting? Who are voices that are alternatives? They've been out there for years and years and years. We're here, but nobody seems to care to actually promote us instead of them. And so, you know, I wonder at some points, what's the motive? Are they just complaining, or do they actually want to promote alternatives? So that's part of the problem, I think.
We have to move on. I'm sorry.
I thought it comes up later, I think, though. We can address it later.
Yes, we can certainly answer more questions. After this is also a related topic, we can maybe get to these questions following these. So our third subtopic is intersectional issues. Questions under this topic include, what commonalities exist in problems faced by women and people of color within secularism? How is an intersectional secular movement critical to success? And how is it critical to fulfilling the stated missions of humanists? Oh, and those are all the questions. So, ladies, take it away. If you want.
One of the, it's so funny, because I think so many black people make this statement, but it's important to just reiterate it every time. Please don't come up to me and say, so what do you, you know, what do black people think about such and such? I don't know what all, you know, X number million of us think. I can tell you what I think, and I can tell you what some of my closest, you know, friends think. But as far as, you know, being inviting, like, I promise you, like, in the groups and stuff, like Facebook groups and stuff, where that's one of the biggest things. Like, can you believe this person was just like, what do all black people, I don't know, girl, they, you know. So just, that's something I always throw out there right from the beginning. It's like, just be mindful of that, guys.
Or people who try to ask me, you know, what should we do about ISIL? You know, I was born and raised in California. I'm not a public policy expert. Please, please. I don't know what we should do about ISIL. It's complicated, right?
Regarding commonalities, commonalities faced by women and people of color, one thing is that the movement has historically been dominated by white men. And I don't want to say, like, white men, white men, white men. But yes, it has been dominated. Still, I think majority participation, I'd say, is probably white men. And there has been more organizing. There have been more groups in the black community. There have been black atheist groups, black non-believer groups. And there have been women getting together and saying, like, our issues, we don't feel like some of them are being addressed or taken seriously. We have some other things we want to talk about. We don't feel comfortable in some spaces. Let's make our own spaces. So, I forget where I was going with this.
Intersectionality.
Had a point. Something, I know, make those spaces. I forgot. Yeah.
Making
terrible.
You're talking about people making their own spaces away from the mainstream spaces.
Yeah, but there's something else.
Oh, okay.
How embarrassing. Damn it. Sorry, I just ruined the whole train.
Yeah, it's okay.
Ruined the panel train.
No. Intersectionality is, I mean, to answer one of the questions, yes, it is critical to success, because there's no way we can have a movement that is successful in its goals without including as many people as possible. You don't want to drive people out for something as simple as that one loud jerk that won't stop yelling about whatever. You want to make sure that you get more people in rather than fewer. And so just from that perspective, just from a numerical perspective, yes, intersectionality is absolutely crucial.
All right, yeah, I sort of know where I was going, but I didn't have a final point. So there are issues in black atheism land. We were talking about some of this yesterday that most white atheists don't know about. I would say mainstream atheism, but what I mean by that is white atheism, not black atheism. Insofar as these are sort of organized, we're talking about majority populations in these groups with some overlap. For example, we see in our Facebook groups and in our communities, our local groups, there is a sometimes poisonous black supremacist or sexist, homophobic, black nationalist presence. And a lot of white atheists I've talked to and that others have talked to do not know that this is something we have to deal with. If we're making groups in our cities, the black non-believers of Metro Orlando, black non-believers of Atlanta, AAH Washington, D.C., for example, they will find black atheists who join who are absolutely sexist, absolutely homophobic, somewhat weird on science, and we have to deal with these issues. That it's a good kind of example of an issue that some subgroup has to face that the mainstream or white population does not really ever see. And when I tell people, they're like, wait, what? What does that even, what's black nationalism?
Wait, you don't know about hoteps?
Yeah, it's actually quite a problem.
Really bad.
And there are groups that, like, when I found that we started a parenting group at CFI Indiana, and they wanted to get secular parents involved, and a problem they found was that there were a lot of atheist parents who were not skeptical, which I didn't really know much about, because most people I know sort of are in both camps. So the fact that there were parents who were like atheists but refusing vaccines, or atheists but instead of chew toys they were putting amber necklaces on their child's necks because somehow that would stop teething, something like that. There were issues that parents had to face that I was completely ignorant of. One of the solutions to that, or one thing that makes that better, is what I said, starting focused groups. In the same way that if you're trying to market a product, you can market to different groups to be effective. 18 to 35-year-olds, different messages will be effective with that group than with retirees who live in retirement homes, and you'll shape your messages appropriately. There are different issues that affect different people, and that's something we found kind of in common, that the mainstream movement sometimes wants to reject. You know, aren't we all human? Aren't we all the same? Why can't you just be in the normal groups? I've actually heard that.
I just want to ask you a quick question. Like, for example, with this extremely fringe type of group, is that something that you think we should bring out to the open and, like, sort of be addressing in this way? Or is that the sort of thing that we need to be, like, behind the scenes, like, you guys are really disgusting human beings. Please go away and don't even call yourself an atheist and lump us in, because we're working really hard to make, like, I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a tricky thing, and we were talking about this yesterday. There's a
because otherwise it's just like a, I don't want it to sound like a bunch of bashing either.
Right, there's a group, there were a couple people in Atlanta, in the black non-believers of Atlanta, who were in line with this sexist kind of black nationalism, and they got kicked out of the group, started their own group called the Black Atheists of Atlanta. They have a cable access show, or had, I don't know if it's still active actually, for years, and they were very fringe. They would say that, for example, an absolutely atheist, evolution shows us that women are supposed to be subservient to men. Men are big and strong, and they're supposed to be the housekeepers and whatnot. And women are weaker, and they're supposed to, or not housekeepers, they're supposed to be in charge of the family. Women are supposed to keep the home. And if you go back to how man is supposed to live in tune with nature, they'd say, then you'd see that in ancient Africa, which is how you find out how man is supposed to live with nature, that men would have four wives, and there was a reason for that. And there's this kind of talks, and also that homosexuality was brought to Africa by Europeans, and that is not a natural way to be, they say. And so, some of the leaders in black atheism land who really don't want this promoted or associated with the rest of us, we decided to just not talk about them.
We're good, not job, Deb. You just talked about them.
I know, we're not going to complain about them. We're not going to post a lot of blog posts about how toxic they are, because it'll give them attention. More people can plug in, and we don't want to be associated with them. Like, they're black atheists, but they're the other black atheists. Like, most people are like, what? Really? That's a thing? And every year or so, like, someone finds out, like, oh my God, did you guys know? And we're like, yeah, we knew. But we talk to other organizers about it. Like, there's organizers will say this. People who run local groups will sometimes say, like, I have a couple people show up with these problems, and we're like, oh yeah, here's how you can deal with that, marginalize them. So, but it's hard, kind of like the Streisand effect, right? Like, you don't want to give them so much attention that it increases their power and their reach, but you can't stop that from happening necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, I think it depends on what kind of issue mm-hmm. is taking place and who it might affect.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. Oh yeah, how is an intersectional secular movement critical to success, you guys?
Mm.
I have an answer.
Okay.
Humanism should be for everybody. That's basically it. Like, it should be for everyone, and it's very hard for us to pay attention to things that aren't in our face. Like, how often do I think about people in Cambodia? Like, never, really. Because I'm not there. I don't know Cambodians. Whatever's happening in Cambodia is not personal. Are they still even a country? I don't even know. Maybe they changed their name. I'm not sure. That's how ignorant I am about that. Like, why would I know about that? It doesn't factor in my life and my connections, right? We do that as humanists, too. We think about our family, our connections, our cultures, our microcultures, and we ignore the things. So one issue I've always been very interested in, because I grew up in a crappy neighborhood in Philadelphia with terrible public schools, where like it was a big announcement when our local high school's graduation rate moved above the 50% mark. There's a reason my parents sent me to Catholic school. I thought that this movement would be more interested in paying attention to public education, because that was an issue that affected my family, my friends, my community a lot. But I found that a lot of people in this movement went to good schools, lived in, you know, nice neighborhoods with good public schools, or really nice private schools. And when we talk about promoting critical thinking, they're just blind to this fact that maybe people are so dumb, which we sometimes wonder why people are so dumb or bad at science, because their schools are poor. And why are their schools poor? What can we do about it? So when it comes to intersectional issues, like, we can't build a movement that's good for all. We can't build a real movement using all the tools we have for making change unless we think about who the all are. You know, when people say, like, why are black people so religious? And it's like, well, what does secularism have to offer? You know, why are the people who were going to my local high school in Philadelphia, Martin Luther King Jr. High School, gonna be interested in attending lectures about the 47 contradictions in the book of Genesis? Mm-hmm. There's nothing in that that relates to most of their lives. So we can be a better, stronger, more successful movement if we think about things intersectionally, if we think about how these things affect different people, different lived experiences that people have on all the axes, the different kinds of axes that exist.
All right, this is great discussion, but if we want time to do a bit of Q&A at the end, which I think we do, we have to get on to the fourth and final subtopic. This is a great segue, actually, talking about systemic inequality and how that affects secular people. Our fourth subtopic is progress. So questions under this subtopic include, what progress has been made by secular activism in favor of the empowerment of women and other marginalized groups? What progress has been made by secular events, groups, and organizations in the past few years? What social progress has been made by third wave feminism in general, in essence, progress within the last 20 years? And how far do we still have to go, if you can answer that kind of question? And then hopefully time for at least five questions at the end. So,
to talk quickly, you guys.
Rousing success, anti-harassment policies.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah, because a couple of years ago when I first got on the scene, there was so much resistance to it. And now there's only, I think, one or two conferences of note that don't have them. And even they claim to have some sort of behind-the-scenes policy. So, again, not naming names, but...
I think just stuff like Facebook, you know what I'm saying, just has made a big impact on people's ability to connect and to form more events and groups and stuff like that. So thanks, Mark Zuckerberg.
One example, actually, of Facebook is Ex-Muslims of North America. We just turned one this year. Before that, when I first came out as an ex-Muslim, there were no ex-Muslim groups that weren't for ex-Muslims who had found Jesus. There were no secular ex-Muslim groups. Mm-hmm. And I was very alone. And now there's an org, and people can Google and find us. And if they don't have to be alone. And Facebook is honestly the best way for us to stay private, because at least I would say 70% of our members are closeted. Mm-hmm. They're not out to their families or their communities. So Facebook has really made that possible. And now that we have an organization, we can get donations. We have 501c3 now. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have tables at events. You know, I don't speak on behalf of it because I'm not an officer, but I can say, hey, I have this affiliation. So yeah, that's definitely a bit of progress there.
I think another one is that conference organizers are more concerned with having diverse lineups than they used to be. There was the amazing meeting conference in Vegas in 2000, I think 10, maybe 11, and there were something like 49 listed speakers. Three of them were women. One of them was a black person. I think that's right. But people complained, like, we're scrolling down the list of speakers and it's white dude. Like, can you do better? And they did. They changed. They add a lot more women to the lineup. And then they used that kind of as a selling point in the future, like, we have a diverse lineup of speakers and then could show that off. Other conferences that have had a decent number of speakers, you know, if it's 10 white men, people have complained to them about it. I've heard from people complaining. I used to have a rule of thumb that if there were six or more speakers at a regional event and they were all white men, I would send them a little email just saying, hey, you might want to be aware that there are resources for finding diverse speakers on these kinds of topics. It was always like helpful. Like, here's a thing that might help your problem that obviously exists, that people care about. And I think people, a lot of conference organizers, instead of just accepting, like, well, let me just find a bunch of scientists and philosophers who are going to tend to be guys, are paying attention to make sure that they have diverse speaker lineups. And speaking of that, not just diverse as in getting women and people of color on the programs, but actually not just having scientists and philosophers too. The movement's broadened. One thing that we're seeing featured more is organizers and activists, bloggers and things too. There were authors before. We have bloggers now too. But we have people who are in the fields doing things, doing community organizing as well. Featured at conferences, being seen as experts and leaders in this field. And I didn't see that when I first got involved 10 or 15 years ago. I saw mostly scientists and philosophers, and this is no bashing, I love science and philosophy, scientists, philosophers, and authors. And now I'm seeing group organizers and, like, outreach, people who are engaged in successful outreach and activism efforts as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's important, like, if you're out there, like, jump in, you know, even if it means, like, you know, being a person to start a local Facebook group or something, you know, we need more women, you know, like I said, I'm one of those, like, science, and I like hard numbers and facts and stuff like that. So, like, let's proportionally, you know, bring up our numbers as far as, you know what I'm saying? Just, like, somebody's got to do the work, you know? So, like, why not you? Not me. I'm a researcher and a writer, so I get to stay behind the scenes. But you guys, come on, more power. Like, let's do it.
And part of it, I think, just to piggyback off that, is a lot of the times when you're a person who has grown up and essentially being told you're inferior in society in any way, you don't feel qualified to speak. You know, it had never occurred to me that I could ask an organization or event to host me speaking. The thought never crossed my mind until I went to an event and I asked a fellow speaker, so how'd you get the gig? And he said, well, I asked them. And I thought, oh, really? You can ask to speak? I thought you had to be invited. You know, it's just, and it's something that, you know, it's really hard to do, because essentially inviting yourself, or, you know, it's hard. My brain doesn't even want to think about what it means for me to go up to an organizer and say, I am worthwhile of your time and your space and your organization's money. That's a scary thing to do. But realize that most speakers are probably at one point were just as qualified as you. You know, if you have something to say, if you have some background in something, you know, you never know what might come of it. I mean, when I applied to Skeptic, that was how I got my start. I thought, you know, I was a nobody. I thought, you know, who the heck would care? And I applied kind of like how you apply to a really high paying job and go, oh, well, we'll see. That'll never happen. But I got in. You know, it's... You know what I mean?
It's funny, high pain.
Yeah, no, skepticism, high pain. But, you know, I thought it was an honor, like, that was only extended to people with, like, 5 million PhDs or something. Yeah. No, not at all. And, you know, you can find your voice and you can find your way. I mean, my first couple of talks weren't the best. But, you know, part of it is realizing there is room to not be perfect. You don't have to be perfect before you get onto things. And I feel like a lot of men understand that, but a lot of women just don't. And that is evidenced by, I'm going to cite a quick statistic here. There was a study they did about people who applied for jobs. Men would apply for a job if they fulfilled 10% of the requirements. Women would only respond if they fulfilled, I think, something like 90% of the requirements. And so I've adopted what I call the 10% mentality. You know, I don't necessarily want to think like a man or whatever, because, but, you know. But the 10% mentality, if I am 10% qualified, why not give it a shot? Why not see where it goes? Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I think more of us, because it had never occurred to me that people were applying for jobs that they weren't actually qualified for. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, I can do that too.
All right, I really hate to shortchange any topic, but if we're going to have time for Q&A, we should probably stop here. All right, so we have about 6 minutes left. I'm going to ask us to keep the questions short so we can have 4 or 5 questions. So let's take some hands.
Hello. I wanted to refer back to something Debbie had said about communities are always complex. I had heard Angela Davis speak on a number of occasions, and on one of the occasions, groups in the audience kept saying to her something that both Candace and Debbie, and I think Hina also mentioned, there are subgroups that only understand that subgroup's problems. And they would get up and say, Angela, tell us we're right. I mean, we want to be a separate subgroup because nobody else understands us. I am the lesbian daughter of a Holocaust survivor. And the only other person who's going to understand me is another lesbian daughter of a Holocaust survivor. And she kept saying to them, true. Yes, sometimes a subgroup's problems can only be understood by the subgroups. However, if you keep breaking into smaller and smaller subgroups, the powers that be are dividing and conquering. And you have to find a common ground. So I guess my question is, how do you both allow for the subgroups to exist, since they do indeed have a need to exist as a subgroup, but also still maintain that larger overall community so that we don't just splinter to the point that we have no power whatsoever?
Group-cessed.
What?
Group-cessed. Cessed. Group-cessed. That's the answer. No, I'm not even kidding here. Most of us are not just part of some subgroup. You know, most of us belong to multiple groups, and we do multiple things. You know, I'm on CFI's Speakers Bureau. I'm on SSA's Speakers Bureau. I'm friends with people in SSA. You know, I'm part of Ex-Muslims in North America. I used to write for Skeptic. Now I'm on Free Thought blogs. You know, I have affiliations with multiple organizations. And most people are like that, so I don't necessarily see, I don't really think it's going to ever splinter to the point where, you know, there's like a group of two and a group of two and a group of two or something like that. If the answer is, you know, I find multiple groups to fit my multiple identities, and generally most people do that, I think.
I like to think of it like the planet. Because I went to this Christian high school once and with someone who was giving a presentation about atheism, and then they grilled him because it was a super duper fundamentalist Christian Bible believing high school, and they were like, well, the earth, like life breaks the second law of thermodynamics. You know, there's more energy and complexity being generated, and it's like the system that you're looking at is too small. You know, like they're like, how is earth getting more complex? And it's like sun comes in, and just also give it time, and we're all going to be nothing soon. But sun energy comes in, and you're not including that in your way you look at the system. And yeah, like a tree gets more complex over time, but like, look at it in a bigger way. If, like, let's say we have in Chicago multiple groups, and a few years ago, a black freethinkers group started in Chicago. And they succeeded at getting more black people involved in the secular movement. They succeeded in reaching out using avenues that other groups weren't considering. And also were in communication with the other groups that existed. They weren't removing people from the other groups because those people didn't exist. A lot of those people didn't exist. And when there were bigger speaker events, they communicated with each other and would show up at each other's events. They were, and Secular Coalition for Reason Is that what they're called? No, sorry, United Coalition of Reason organizes this way, where they're like, there might be a free thought group, an atheist group, a skeptic group, whatever, in your area, and campus groups, but sometimes you all come together for a thing. Other times, you know, the campus group doesn't want to hang out with the community group, maybe, right? Having campus groups and community groups, though, isn't splitting the movement further. It's different things that appeal to different people with different needs in mind. Having a parenting group for parents is not harming us all. So sometimes, yes, there are... I can understand why people would think, like, well, that group's being separatist. They refuse to work with anyone. They're pulling all the women away, something like that, right? Again, it's complex stuff. Yeah, people are complex. But a lot of times, most of what I've seen is this helps. This helps us with our outreach. This helps us with offering things that are relevant to people in different groups. And even if we have, as the movement grows, we should expect to have more than one group out there for the different needs and different goals and objectives for different groups. And then we can still come together at something like the Reason Rally and have 25,000 people show up with 30 sponsoring organizations with a bigger goal in mind and everyone working together.
All right, let's take another question.
I'd just like to return to one of the earlier topics, which brought up the bad behavior of some of the best known men in the secular movement. Don't you think, really, that a little bit too much is being made of this? The secular movement is not the Roman Catholic Church. Richard Dawkins is not the Pope. Sam Harris and Danny Dennett are not cardinals. And I think the best way, and I don't think it's true, by the way, that nobody answers them, but I do think it's true, and I'd like to hear from the panel about this, that basically, not just women, but who doesn't agree with whatever, and I don't mean what people are purported to have done, reports of which I'm always very skeptical about, by the way. I'm not particularly impressed by a lot of the documentation of some of these, but I disagree with a lot of these guys on a lot of things. You tell them about it. You write them about it. You speak up for yourself. This seems to me that it is a correction that is up to us to make, not up to getting a lot of other people to stand and getting mad about the fact that people still buy Richard Dawkins's books and all that. That's nonsense. We can speak up for ourselves, can't we?
The problem is, I think that, you know, Richard Dawkins and all those people have megaphones on a level that a lot of us don't, because a lot of us do speak up against them and say, you know, that doesn't represent us, that's not who we are. But, you know, the megaphones aren't from atheists, or at least not exclusively. There's not enough atheists in the world to give them the platform that they have. It's people outside of atheism who have decided that Dawkins is the Pope. It's people in the media who decide every time they want to talk about atheism, they have to talk about Richard Dawkins' latest tweet. Mm-hmm. You know, one guy's Twitter feed somehow becomes the voice for all of atheism. And that's something I think against which I'm trying to agitate a lot and say, you know, get in other voices, because if you're going to keep giving them that platform, they're going to keep saying what they want to say, and no one else is really going to be heard.
But it really is possible. And one thing that I think people who disagree with various things have to do is keep trying to get into those same platforms in which other people have decided mm-hmm. that certain people are representatives. It really is possible, and I think we're getting a lot closer to the critical mass. But people have to stand up. It's the same thing you were saying about with harassment. And by the way, I've encountered a lot more harassment at other kinds of professional gatherings. Free thought people have really high standards for themselves in the sense that you go to a journalistic convention, the amount of harassment you're going to get is 10 times what it is at a free thought convention. But journalists are worried about it.
I am sorry.
All right, we are actually out of time.
Damn it!
It's past 11.
But I had to say,
I'm sorry, we don't have more time. We have another panel coming right up. I'd like to thank all of our panelists, Candace, Debbie, Hina. Good discussion. Can you get a round of applause for that?